Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud. And I need to start reminding you that the election season is kind of kicked off. We've got Jerry Wistrand out of Missouri, who's running for the auditor's office. We've got his pledge signed. We've already interviewed him, and we'll be actually bringing him back in to talk about the political environment that he's running in and the problems of the party, because not every state is Wyoming. And I cannot tell you how good it is to work with a state party apparatus that embraces the Constitution. It's a night and day difference from conservatives to the Constitution.
Yeah.
One of the fights I tend to get, or resistance, is the willingness to do everything. I mean, I don't want to state this wrong. It's not the everything that we do is in his name, but to be focused on a biblical Christian slant regarding the Constitution is not necessary. And as a matter of fact, I say this all the time, our Creator understood where this nation would actually start falling and becoming godless, to where the majority of the people now do not look at this nation and this Constitution as one that was based upon him. But the one thing that most people do recognize is that's a great document. The way it establishes the authority for government to function, most people can get on board with the fact that, you know, they can only do these things. And with that, that's where we can unite on with people. And that's where it's hard on the Republican Party to give up the platitudes, because they want to have in their platform the importance of stopping abortion and the importance of stopping homosexual marriage and the importance of stopping all of these moral issues, when in fact the reality is neither the state or the federal government have the authority to regulate those things. I only know one or two states that have actually amended their constitution to regulate marriage. And I believe that's Hawaii and Washington State, where they went down this path of basically amending their constitution to allow the state to dictate what marriage is. And that's a huge mistake. Huge mistake. So with that, I just want you to understand that until people start looking in ways to unite instead of divide, because if you're coming to the table with anything other than the Constitution, and you've got an agenda to basically say we need to create a moral generation, well, we can't do that, but he can. And he can't do that when the Constitution's been perverted and they've got their heels on our necks. If we can join and unite in getting government back into the framework of the Constitution, then we'll be free to actually proselyte and grow a moral nation again. So you can't put the cart in front of the horse, because that is a losing proposition. I've said it for over 50 years. When you go in to fight on the grounds that abortion is immoral, wrong, and a sin, even though it makes you feel good because you're right, but the reality is the government has no authority to be involved in it. That wins the argument. So do you want to feel good or do you want to win the argument? And that is my struggle, because they believe that if they actually take the constitutional argument, that they're failing him. But they don't realize that that's his constitution. And he did this so that we could win in these days to restore this Constitution. Only he knew this. I'm telling you, John Adams had no clue when he said that that Constitution was written for a moral and just, you know, and righteous nation. And I'm here to tell you that he wrote that Constitution so that we could use it in these days to restore the system he gave us. So I believe that John Adams was completely wrong, that that Constitution wasn't made for them in their righteous days. It was made for us in our immoral turpitude, or I should say in the turpitude of this nation's mores. Anyway, anywho, thank you for the amens back there. Because
yes, you're welcome.
See, Tammy's from Wyoming, and she, you know, she knows that it's, you know, you've won the battle if you're standing on the Constitution and getting other states. I can't believe Idaho. Well, I can. So some of these other states actually have a, you know, organizations that are soothsayers. And what I mean by that is there's organizations out there that refuse to basically to unite with us. There are organizations that fight me, and they, you know, they call me, you know, disparaging, you know, they attack me personally. Oh, you don't want to do, yeah, that guy's a bad guy. We have no idea what he's really doing, but we don't think it's any good. And so you just, so they use their laurels of how good that they've been to convince people to just, yeah, you're better off not working with that guy. Because it's happened several times where organizations go, oh, man, you know what? We're not going to work. And the problem is that, and this happened in Wyoming. I'll just give you a little history. In Wyoming, this organization started attacking me personally. And I pointed this out to the party leadership and so forth. And I go, isn't it interesting that they can't argue against what I'm doing and what we're asserting and why this is important? They don't even touch this stuff. They're only attacking me and some misunderstandings they're getting from my first book. And I mean, it's very ambiguous. And to today's paradigms, everybody just allows these types of little arguments, these ad hominem arguments, to affect them because they believe that they have that weight to, you know, if they give you advice not to go down that path, you're going to follow them. Not giving you good advice, bad advice, to basically is not on an academic argument, advice that's more on feelings and, you know, these personal things. So, so in Wyoming, there were individuals that, you know, had these whispers in their ears, and they said, hey, you know, I don't think this is a good thing to do. And the problem was when we pushed back and said, okay, so let's talk, let's get into the nuts and bolts of what we're doing and what's the problem. What is the problem here? And dead silence. It was crickets. But there are still people, and some of these people are leaders in Wyoming, but they're not necessarily leaders in the party, fortunately. But there are leaders out there, and they really, these are good friends of theirs that have said, you know, that, that have attacked me. And they would rather believe that personal attack than actually go, you know what, let's talk about the issues specifically. Let's dive into this. I'm ready to, you know, open up some books and let's look at the academic argument here. So anyway, so fortunately we've had these little coup d'etats, we've had these little resistances and so forth, but we're very successful because over the past few years we've actually seen the state house turn, I'm going to use the word conservative, because we've gotten more people that are more concerned about, you know, conservative things than, you know, the liberal things, which is a good thing. But we would be far better off if the state house was 100% Constitution, because then we would have had legislation passed already, and there would be conversations happening amongst states and so forth that would be really having a direct impact on turning this government around. Anyway, so folks, we depend upon you. And this is one of the reasons why we continue to die. I mean, we go through the nuts and bolts of the Constitution, the ratification debates, the Constitutional Convention, Madison's notes on it, and the Constitution itself. I mean, what more? How much more constitutional can we get? We're not going to touch the Federalist Papers, and we've told you why. If you want to know why, I've got an article coming out in the details, so you can dive into that. But when it comes to the content, we're here to help educate and inform. That way, you can make your appeal to heaven to follow that, you know, three-step advice: learn, pray, and act. Everything we are seeking and everything that has to be done to fix our problem, all of our problems will go away. All of our government problems go away if we get and obtain full compliance to the U.S. Constitution. That's simple. Now, I think it's interesting because we haven't covered this lately, but I think it's interesting that we're at the brink of possibly war, a two-front war. Do you know what I'm talking about, Tammy?
I think so.
Okay. So, Trump is pushing matters into China's lap, and obviously he's pushing matters into Russia's lap. And we could push and push and push, which would take us into war. But why? Why would we actually do something like that instead of pushing internally with both of these nations by going to Taiwan, Hong Kong, and other provinces and other nations that are under the grasp, like Nepal, appealing to these other nations to get them to break away from China and to apply to become territories and be put on statehood path with the United States? Why rattle sabers when you can actually create movements of revolutions? People where they, you know, I can't imagine a scenario where China would even look halfway decent by using armed forces, or I should say deadly force, in suppressing people from leaving them for seeking a better governing, a better government for themselves, to become states in the union. That right there is what will change the course of this world. Going into war is the status quo, and every time we do this, we do this unconstitutionally, and this is how, you know, we have been throwing our own good young men and women nowadays, young men and women, into harm's way to die when they don't have the constitutional standing to send the army overseas. Anyway, so
I wonder if they've even thought about that idea.
Well, I've been using this argument for a long time, and I was on the air when I actually had my show in 2016. I said it on a regular basis. If Trump really wants to change the direction of the world and grow America's power and make America even greater, it would be by soliciting all these places that are under the tyranny of China. Like I said, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Nepal, and other places like Africa and so forth, and say, hey, you, if you're tired of being tossed to and fro by these despots and you know, tyrannical governments, then why don't you seriously consider, as a people, to determine whether it would be worth your while to become a member of the union? There are stipulations to that. You'll be put into a territorial status, and it'll be a while before you could, you know, become citizens and those types of things, but still, we will protect you and help you transition. Why not? I think it'd be cheaper to do that than to continue fight these wars.
Yeah, I mean, China would definitely go against them in war, wouldn't they?
Well, so
if they did that,
if they tried to use deadly force by attacking Taiwan, who actually, in a democratic process, they all chose in an open election that was monitored internationally, that Taiwan wanted to fully cut its ties to China and become a state in the Union, an independent and sovereign state within the Union under our Constitution. Wow. Now, if China basically says, we're not going to allow you to have this choice, you must be under our thumb because we can inflict this. That right there goes in every way against all humanity and what is right in dealing and allowing people to choose. The whole world would look at China as crossing that line. Right? Maybe the only nation or a few nations that would say, hey, we have every right to inflict communism upon everybody, whether you like it or not. How dare you? And those nations would be North Korea, Cuba, Russia, right? These hardcore communist nations. Venezuela. If you want to literally change the direction of the world and really make it a better place, we got to stop these. Because who's winning at these wars? It's not the people. It's not the people. So anyway,
that's an extremely good point. I've never thought about that.
Yes, and that's why the Constitution had a mechanism to allow any state to apply to become a state in the Union. Now nobody ever thought about it. Back in the old days, it was nationalism, nationalism, nationalism. You know, Europe was constantly at war with itself, the nations within Europe, because it was about nationalism. Don't cross our line. This is us. Instead of uniting. I mean, when Germany was the great state that it was, you know, back in the 1500s, you know, it was a united Germany. And over time, who is it that constantly divides and conquers? Who's the divisive one? If you could name an entity that, you know, you could say that is the divisive entity. Satan.
England?
No. Satan. Satan is constantly trying to create contention. He is the spirit of contention. He tries to create contention all the time. And what he does is he gets people to, you know, to focus on something, what's best for us, not what's best for all of us. And most people are fearful of becoming a part of a union or, you know, giving up, compromise, what have you. But technically, everything that they've been doing is nothing but compromise for the agenda instead of compromising for liberty. Because one actually makes life better. The other one just it makes government better. So anyway, all right. So we're in the Bill of Rights. And we just covered the Eighth Amendment. So now we actually get the one amendment that is the catch-all amendment. When you really think about it, this amendment can probably be used in almost every argument that you have. Almost every argument, like parental rights, you know, health freedom, these types of things. So let's go ahead and read this short amendment. Go ahead, Tammy.
All right. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people.
Okay, so what does that mean to you? What's he saying there? The enumeration in the Constitution. So let's say there's something in the Constitution that basically provides, a law, a standard, or what have you. And I'll give you a good case in point. Well, they created Obamacare. Now, let's just say they amended the Constitution to create Obamacare. Just like in the Constitution, they have what they call the, you know, the Declaration of War, the power to go and make war with a nation, go to war. Do they not have a stipulation and or a contingency that a person cannot be forced to take up arms to kill somebody at wartime? What I mean by that is it's called the conscientious objector, right?
Uh-huh.
A person can conscientiously object to being, you know, forced into taking up arms to go kill people if they feel that it's just an immoral thing to do. Now, it's one thing if we're being attacked and defending oneself, but to go to a foreign nation to protect the power that is in place now, or to possibly overthrow the power that is in force, in other words, to pursue a regime change, that right there is not something that a person would feel like that's not my, you know, godly duty. Defending myself is a godly duty. So there's always a way for you to be protected, and a conscientious objection is not only applied to war. Can you conscientiously object to a religious dogma? Let's say you're going to school and the school is providing education on Satanism, Islam, godlessness, communism, what have you. If they're teaching that, and as a parent, you don't want your children to be subject to that, you can actually have your children removed. Right? Okay. So conscientious objection can be used almost in every... Go ahead.
Like the movie Hacksaw Ridge. Okay. Have you seen that movie?
Was that Clint Eastwood?
Hacksaw Ridge, that was directed by Mel Gibson.
Oh, okay.
Where there was a conscientious objector.
Okay. No, I've not seen it.
He never took up any arms.
Right. Okay, so depending on the situation, a person could be a conscientious objector in taking up arms, but not be a conscientious objector in taking up arms, because in defending oneself, that's different than going and fighting a war for somebody. So anyway, when it's enumerated that they can do these things, that cannot be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And one that is retained by the people is conscientious objection. Another one that's coming into big play nowadays is parental rights. And the rights over your children, you know, to have the full control and say over what's best for your child. Because states are passing laws left and right, assuming that parents and parental rights don't exist. And the Ninth Amendment protects you from that. I would be hard-pressed to think how the Ninth Amendment would not be in play on almost any time a person's rights are being taken away. I'll give you another good case in point. When they're passing laws that basically require, well, we're going into break here, so I'll keep this and I'll bring this up when we come back. But I was going to bring up HOAs and or other city ordinances and so forth that basically limit your ability to use your property. So when we come back, we'll talk about that and how the Ninth Amendment would be in play. I mean, the Ninth Amendment is almost in play for any time it comes to your rights. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're talking about the Ninth Amendment and the HOA. So, and or your city ordinances, because Paul Venable told me that he lives in a town and he has property for chicken coops and he can have chickens. It's not like they're living on top of each other where it'd be a health problem or anything like that. But they're passing laws that make it impossible for you to be able to subside from your property. In other words, being able to utilize your property to sustain yourself, to survive, to have chickens. Now, HOAs try to get away with, oh, well, it's a contract, you signed it, and you are bound to the contract. To be honest, folks, no state can make or enforce any law like a contract that abridges your privileges and immunities guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. And you have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and our property, basically. And so when you look at these laws, they don't stand up to the Constitution. They actually defy the Constitution, and all it's doing is creating a tyrannical mess, and it's ignoring these rights that we have, because we have a right in surviving, right? And that goes into the Ninth Amendment, that certain rights shall not be construed to deny. In other words, their right to create this HOA and the right to be able to tell you, you can't paint your home a certain color. Now, I don't know if there's ever been a religious argument that you've got to have a certain color for your home. But, you know, I believe property rights are immutable. You know, a person has a right to do what they want to with their property. And HOAs are nice. They're tyrannical. They're, you know, the people who usually run them are despots. But they have an intent in trying to maintain, they believe they're trying to maintain a property value for the entire estate. In other words, all the homes within the estate. But the reality is that there's not one thing that they do that actually guarantees that your property value won't go down or won't go up. In other words, you can actually do things, and a good case in point, you could color your house a bright yellow. I mean, and it would be just ghastly to every, oh boy, look at that, that's just so obscene, it's too bright. And somebody could come along and pay more money because they just love that color. So beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And when it comes to selling property, the value of the property and the assessments that they create based on comps and based on the housing in the area around one or another, then the fact is that has no dictate on how and what price your house will sell. As a matter of fact, I proved this when we sold our home in California. We had a ghastly yellow home. We sold right before Christmas. Everybody said, you can't sell your home at Christmas time. We got an offer that they paid us more than what we were looking for because they wanted the house. And we sold it at a value that was well above the comps. In other words, if these people were going to go out and have to get a loan, they'd have to come up with the money in hand to cover the difference of what they'd have to, what they're paying for this home, from what the comps would have basically stated from the banks. Because comps in real estate is basically playing a game so that the bank can get the house at the lowest price possible. Because then it's in their advantage that they can, you know, sell it if they have to take your home from you. Now, here's another one. In every state right now, people are losing their homes because there's people stealing your titles and creating loans against your title. It's called title theft. And there's ads that are out there. And there are laws that are allowing banks to take your property from you when they can't prove that you did that. They can't prove that it was you that did that. And if you make the claim, I didn't do that, they're still going to kick you off your property. And it's just repugnant to me that any state in this union would allow banks that kind of power, because the bank wins. Do you understand? The bank didn't have a full mortgage with that person. These are second mortgages. They get second, thirds, and fourth, and fifth mortgages onto that home to where it's so heavily leveraged that the bank that comes in with the largest claim gets to take it. And as far as I'm concerned, I think all of the banks should take a loss. The banks should have the onus to prove that you legitimately have the authority to take out that loan against that home. And you know who the other culprits are, is the government itself. Because they make these deeds available for people to utilize. In other words, if that information wasn't just readily available, and if a person actually had to come down and sign for and prove who they were, so that you got their thumbprint, you know, some basic information, so that if you had to go after that person, boom, you could find them and arrest them. Because bottom line, there's got to be measures that protect your property, and they're not doing that. They're leaving you vulnerable so that the bank can take your property. And to me, I can't believe the state legislatures have not dealt with this. It's just like these tire lobbyists that come in and convince the state legislatures to say, hey, we don't care how responsible our citizens are. Let's stick it to them and make them buy a tire sooner than they probably would if they weren't being forced to have to buy tires. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so when it comes, go ahead. That's what?
No, I mean, that's just infuriating, the tire thing.
Yeah, it is, and I believe, you know, I'm an advocate for holding people accountable, so that if somebody has an accident and because they were driving recklessly, or they were driving in conditions on tires that were suspect, then I think that they should be held accountable. But when it comes to any and all of these things, the Ninth Amendment should actually protect you. And bottom line, when you go into these types of things, they say, hey, you have to buy a tire. I have a right not to buy a tire. Well, we're not going to sell it to you, because they want to hide behind the law. And so it forces us to have to actually go and deal with these things. And they think, and this is the kicker, folks, they believe that you're going to go into court and stand up against the law with the court. And I'm telling you right now, because the courts are corrupt, the courts will rule in favor of, you know, the law, instead of actually in favor of you and your rights, and give you justice. This is why when we look at petitioning government for the redress of grievances, it's not to go to court. The petition for the redress of grievances is to go to the legislature, your county legislature, your state legislature, to Congress, and to say, hey, this is wrong. A good case in point, the invasion. The invasion should go to Congress, but your county legislature has skin in the game because they're being inflicted by overruns, and there's not a county in America that has not had invaders or invaders living in it, invaders working in it, invaders in it. At least, if there are, they're very few. But the point is this, is that your county legislators have the responsibility to hold your state legislators accountable to what they should be doing in enforcing the Constitution. So the whole point of going to your county legislatures is to rattle the cage of your state legislature to say, look, we've got an invasion, and the Constitution dictates that these invaders would be repelled. And Congress needs to repel them because that's what the Constitution says. So do your job and tell Congress to do their job in accordance with the Constitution. And that's how crap rolls downhill. Because the top government for the people is the county. Now, you can, in some cases, you can drill down below that, but there's not one case yet in America. There's not one case where a county has been managed down to a lower level to where the county becomes more of a general government, like L.A. Los Angeles County can become a general government and actually manage, or underneath it have these sub-districts that would actually be where your legislative bodies would be. So it'd be just an extra layer just because you've got too many people in one area. But nevertheless, the point is this, is that everybody expects you to go to court. It's going to cost you money, and you're not going to get justice, nor will you get results. So bottom line, why are we always turning to the courts? Why do we allow ourselves, why do we allow the lawyers to convince us, oh, well, we got to go to court over this, when we shouldn't? We shouldn't be doing that, folks. So anyway, I think that runs to ground how the Ninth Amendment is almost in play whenever it comes to your rights. Whenever any right is being disparaged, nine times out of ten, they've created some powers to step on that, or they're making presumptions, and that's a deadly game when government makes presumptions. The next amendment is the Tenth Amendment, so we should be able to get through this because I think this is pretty concise, and... Well, let's actually go ahead and read the Tenth Amendment. Go ahead.
Okay. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
Okay. So the Constitution delegates very specific powers to the federal government. And the Constitution restricts states from being able to do certain things, right?
Yep.
Okay, so there's restrictions on states, and there are powers delegated to the federal government. And oh, by the way, there are restrictions on the federal government as well. But that's why it starts off with powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states. In other words, if there's something in the Constitution that prohibits states from doing it, then that's not in play. But all things that aren't delegated nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, Tammy, does that mean that the states have the power to do everything? Based on what that says,
certainly not.
Okay, what are the states empowered to do?
The states are empowered to make laws that protect your rights.
Okay, let's look at this in the way that we, for being consistent, the states can only make laws, and the state can only do things that the people delegated to them to do. The people can delegate powers to the state that are not delegated to the federal government, such as the ability to create roads, highways, waterways, and to regulate those roads, to come up with traffic standards, such, so forth and so on. because that's not delegated to the federal government, right? Right?
Right.
Okay. So did you ever see the three presidential vetoes of the Department of Transportation? It's a video I did with the Wyoming GOP in 2020. This lays out the case that the power to create the Department of Transportation, for the federal government to be involved in the improvement or the creation of highways and waterways, airways and all these other things that we have today, now railways, that they don't have the authority in the Constitution to be involved in that.
Right.
Okay, so they don't have the authority. They've assumed that authority, and they have gotten the states to basically kind of do their bidding for them, but technically the states don't have in their Constitution, if you go to the Wyoming Constitution, you look for the authority for the state of Wyoming to create highways, to regulate the railways in the state, and all of that type of thing, I'm going to guess you probably won't find that power delegated. But the question is, does the state have the ability, do the people have the ability to actually delegate or grant that power to the state to do?
Sure, as long as it's stated in the state constitution.
There you go. So in other words, you have to amend the constitution for the state to be able to regulate the highways. They're regulating the highways because the federal government tells them to, when the federal government doesn't have the authority to do that. You see my point?
Yes.
That's the same thing with energy. Most states don't have the authority to regulate energy. Who's doing that? The federal government's doing that. And they're getting the states to regulate it as well. So when we really start peeling this back, we realize that even though the states have all these powers that, you know, are under the sun, until you grant them those powers, those powers don't exist yet. It's not that they can't do them. You have to grant them. That makes sense. Okay. All right. Well, so when you look at when you look at Madison and the interposition point where he talks about how the federal government only has the ability to do certain things and how interposition is literally the thing that has to be done to hold the federal government accountable. It's interesting how the convention of state folks come along every year and they say, hey, we need to have a convention to get the states or to get the federal government into, you know, abiding by the Constitution. And they make these arguments like, you know, well, you know, the Constitution needs to be clarified. No, it doesn't. I think the 10th Amendment is very clear. Powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states and the people. Or powers not delegated to the states by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. So, in other words, when you look at the 10th Amendment, how can you even, when you understand what the 10th Amendment lays out, how is it that you can actually say we need a convention to get the government to comply? We don't need a convention. Go ahead.
What is the convention of states people's argument? You know, because if they're already not complying with the Constitution, what good is it doing to change the Constitution? They're still not going to comply with it. So have you had that conversation? What is there?
Right.
Why do they think that changing the Constitution is going to get them to comply?
Yeah, okay. So one of their primary arguments is, the only thing in the Constitution to deal with the federal government is the Article 5 Convention. And it's like they completely obviate. I mean, the First Amendment has been completely removed. Because the First Amendment is where we're told the process in holding government accountable if they're doing things that they shouldn't be doing. So the question is, why are they calling for a convention and say that that's the only process, when actually the real process of holding government accountable isn't a convention. It is the First Amendment petition for the redress of grievances.
Right.
Okay. So now we're going to dive into the Bill of Rights. And so if you would, go ahead and let's read the preamble to the Bill of Rights. It's that the articles, in addition to the amendments of the, actually, the Bill of Rights is where we go. Let me go to the Bill of Rights. There we go. And there is a preamble that is right under there that is got a little highlight to it, but it's a short little paragraph. Let's read that preamble. Go ahead.
The judicial power?
The conventions of a number of states under the Bill of Rights. You've got the color-coded Constitution up.
I don't know where you're at.
Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. We just went through the Bill of Rights, and I actually believe that, help me out here, that Sean, bad with names, sorry about that. Sean actually read this. So we just finished the 10th Amendment. So now we're going to go through the additional amendments to the Constitution. So the next amendment is actually the 11th Amendment. I'm sorry. My bad.
Okay. That's all right. The judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens of subjects of any foreign state.
Okay. Now, if you can split your screen, we need to go to Article 3 in the top view. And if you don't know how to do it, because we're sharing the screen, I can actually do that. And that way we can kind of look at the color-coded Constitution. Where is the color-coded Constitution? All right, so I'll do this, and I'll pull it up, hopefully this way, open. And apologize, folks, because bottom line, what we're trying to do is we want to do a comparison and contrast against against the 11th Amendment and Article 3, Section 2. And so to do that, we actually need to read what was delegated in Article 3, Section 2. We kind of did this when we covered Article 3. But we need to do the due diligence in going through the, I'll just say, the powers or the jurisdiction delegated. That way we can actually contrast that to what was taken away. So as I look at this document, okay, I'm going to close that. Now I'm going to split the screen. You can see this now, right?
Let's see. Yep.
Okay. Now, what I'm going to do by splitting the screen, we're looking at both Section 2 of Article 3, and we're going to look at the 11th Amendment. And there's the 11th Amendment. Actually, shoot. And we want the 11th Amendment here. Sorry. And we want Article 3, Section 2 there. All right. So now we can see the jurisdiction. So in Section 2, what we've done with the color-coded Constitution, folks, is in the areas that were amended, what we do is we italicize those words that have been changed. In other words, the words that are there are the original words, but the words that get inserted, what you have to do in your head, because the way the Constitution is printed and managed, they don't insert these words because that would delete those other words. They want to keep the original words and add the changes at the bottom. And so that's why we have this little problem of what the jurisdiction really is. So, again, you just read, the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the states by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. Now, what we have here, and these are the words that have been changed because they're no longer applicable, because in this amendment, they lumped everything into any type of suit of law or equity that is of a citizen or a foreigner that is not a citizen of a state, and they're suing a state that they're not a citizen of, then the federal court will not have jurisdiction over that. And so when you look at all of these clauses, all of these clauses is dealing with a citizen of a different state suing a state or a foreigner suing a state. In other words, both times, in both cases, they're not citizens of that state. And the Constitution actually granted jurisdiction originally to those types of cases. And the states actually, because if you remember, going through the ratification debates, the states were, the people were constantly complaining about that part of Article 2, or Article 3, Section 2, I mean. So these are the words that are in Article 3, Section 2. Between a state and citizens of another state, between citizens of different states, it's basically meaning the same thing, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states. In other words, the citizen of one state claiming a land grant of another from another state, and between a state or citizens thereof and foreign states or citizens or subjects. So the one thing that actually kind of stands out is the foreign states is, and I need to highlight that as red, because that right there happens to bring in what I would say as a case that would have to be viewed to determine if it is truly a foreign state suing, like Mexico suing Texas, in that type of case, or is it a person in Mexico suing? Because if it is an international entity that is actually doing the lawsuit, then, and this is where you really got to drill into it, because 9 times out of 10, those lawsuits come up from people. They come up from cases, but every once in a while, it is actually a state to state or state to the federal. But for the most part, all of these words now have been suspect of change, because the context of them has to be very precise for the federal government to actually have jurisdiction over these things. And in the land grants of different states, of other states claiming land grants of different states, that would apply if, let's say, Kentucky, the state of Virginia, created land grants, and those land grants are still possessed by the state of Virginia, and Kentucky became a state. And so if the issue became an issue regarding Virginia actually having these land grants, then that would cause a pause and basically force everybody to go, okay, this is actually a case between a state and a different state, not really a citizen and a state. But if it is a citizen and another state, then it is not jurisdiction, or the federal government doesn't have jurisdiction. The 11th Amendment, we'll bring this up in our next show, folks. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.